Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and this is the second part of our series around the field trip we're taking to Arctic Canada with Dr. Martin Brazeau of Imperial College London. Having contextualised the field trip in the first episode, we now discuss the logistics of the trip. How do you go about making this kind of expedition happen? What are some of the challenges we will face? What will life be like in the camp? And how can we get our priceless fossils home? Following this episode, the next few will all be recorded in the field and can only be released once we get back from the trip. So other than the regular podcast, of which we've got a couple of pre-recorded episodes, this will be the last you hear from me for about 6 weeks. I'm hoping that this expedition will be a unique opportunity to show a research project from inception through to completion. So if you're enjoying this special series, please like and share it on social media, as it all really helps with our exposure. We hope you're enjoying this series. Hi, Martin. Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to hear from you again. Good to be here.
Where are you now?
I am in Ottawa right now. We're very near Ottawa. So, preparing to go on the trip.
Why Ottawa?
So, a couple of reasons. Most of the flights to the north are out of here. So you fly to Iqaluit, then on to Resolute via a few intermediate stops. And so pretty much all those flights begin in Ottawa. So it's a good place to get started, and it's convenient for me because it's where I'm from. It's home for me. So it's quite convenient to stay here with family and tie up loose ends and get any odds and ends we need for the trip ready. And then on to the next stage of the journey.
And is the rest of the team there with you already? Is everyone assembled apart from me?
Yeah, everyone except this one guy.
The pain.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, let's get down to business. And let's first of all just recap on what the hypothesis we're looking to test is. Why are we going on this field trip?
Well, there's a couple of objectives. Some are kind of direct hypothesis testing objectives, and some are a little more exploratory, but the main objective here is to learn about who the earliest gnathostomes are, who the earliest jawed vertebrates are that show up in the record before the beginning of the age of fishes. So who are the earliest players in the rise of the age of fishes just before the beginning of the Devonian period?
Okay, and where in the world are you going to find these new gnathostome specimens?
So we are headed to the Canadian Arctic for this trip, which in particular, we're headed to Cornwallis Island, which is right in the middle of the Canadian Arctic archipelago.
And why this place? What's it got there in particular? I mean, if you're targeting this one really specific place, then surely these gnathostomes have been found. And then what's the purpose of going back if we know they're there already?
Although it's in the Arctic, which is quite a remote place to get to, Cornwallis Island is logistically one of the most straightforward places to work because it is the base of the Polar Continental Shelf Program, which is the Canadian government's major operations in the Canadian Arctic, and they help us organize logistics. So from a purely practical perspective, it's relatively easy to work there compared to other parts of the North. But most importantly, it's sort of in the center of an area that's been known to produce early jawed vertebrate fossils. So we're headed to this area in the hopes that we will be able to find more.
Well, there's places just over the river from me in where I am in Bristol. You get into Wales and you can find early fishes. So why concentrate on this place instead of places that we know definitely produce fossils and there are a lot easier to get to?
They're a lot easier to get to. But the issue with finding fossils, especially things that are very rare. So when you think about it, we're going down in time. We're going to the earliest part of the record, and fossils in the early part of a group's record tend to be much rarer. And so basically you need to have more access to the bedrock, the rocks in which the fossils are found. And in Wales, most of the good rocks, which are, there are plenty, but they're covered by ground cover, trees, grass, and fields. And exposure of that rock is pretty rare, pretty sporadic, and often just restricted to small building stone quarries. What you'd like to have is an area where the bedrock is extremely well exposed, that you don't need to dig opportunistic holes in the ground, but where you can walk for miles and miles just looking at the ground beneath your feet. And that just increases the chances that you'll come across fossils that are interesting and worth collecting.
Okay, and what's already been found? Like, what kinds of fossils and by whom?
Yeah, so over the years, especially since about the 1950s, especially thanks to an increase in natural resource exploration during that time, early geological mappers and geologists, stratigraphers working in that area, working in the Canadian Arctic, found fossil fishes in the Silurian and in the Devonian rocks across the Canadian Arctic. In particular, very well known geologist Ray Thorsteinsson, who found a number of excellent fossil fish sites across the Canadian Arctic, as well as David Dineley and others. And so they collected quite a bit of material from various places, but very rarely did they focus on extended, say, excavations or studying areas all over the Arctic. So a lot of workers worked on areas south of Cornwallis Island, Somerset Island and Prince of Wales Island. And we actually know something about the geography, the paleogeography of that area. And we know that those areas were much closer to shore or even on shore, that they were rivers and deltas. And north of, into Cornwallis Island and north of Cornwallis Island, the rocks become more of a sort of a reef type facies, so associated with the reef, the lagoon, and then over the edge of the reef into the deep water environments. And those are areas that are much less well studied and potentially have a lot more fish diversity in them.
And is it just fish that we find?
No, there's all kinds of invertebrate fossils, arthropods, and various sort of reef-building organisms. So you name it, there's all kinds of animal fossils and even excellent plant fossils in these areas.
You've not said the E word.
Oh, Eurypterids. Ah, yes. Well, there are arthropods and there are Eurypterids. Certainly fragments of Eurypterid have been found and even some articulated specimens in the Devonian.
And I cannot wait. So it sounds like a great field trip. Is it just the case that you call up the people on Cornwallis and say, hey, we want to come digging? Is that fine? Who did you need to get the field trip approved by? Is it the government? Is it the people in the park rangers? Or what's the situation?
Well, it starts something like what you said. You start getting in contact with the relevant stakeholders. There's no park in that area, which is good for our purposes, only in the sense that it limits the amount of extra bureaucracy we have to deal with. Not saying that parks are a bad thing, of course. Parks are a very good thing, but it does simplify the process for us. So the main thing is you need to make sure that logistically it's even feasible. And so you discuss the ideas with the Canadian Polar Continental Shelf Program, who help you design logistics. You get in touch with, or you communicate with, the community or communities concerned. In this case, you get in touch with the community in Resolute, which is the only town on Cornwallis Island, just to inform them of your work. You get in touch with, of course, the Nunavut government. You need to go through a number of different applications. There's a planning proposal, which makes sure that you're not doing any activities that are destructive or, you know, building structures and that kind of thing that would require more oversight. You have a water board permit, which is not an instrument of torture, of course, but just making sure the type of work you're doing isn't going to be creating water pollution or diverting major water sources or anything like that. You, of course, need to apply for a paleontology permit from the government if you're going to be working in areas that are Inuit-owned lands under the land claims agreement. Then you need to apply to the appropriate community to make sure that the community can evaluate your project and determine whether or not, you know, this is something they should have a stake in. So there's a series of different things that you have to go through in order to make sure that your work can be done in the Canadian Arctic.
And locally for you, was there anything with getting permission from your university to have the time off?
No, that's fairly straightforward. You do a risk assessment and, of course, make sure that you declare that you have you're going away on business-related travel, of course. But of course, this is part of what I do. The term is over now. And yeah, it's on to do field work.
And in general, getting the field trip approved, was this easier than you expected or was it a nightmare?
No, we have very good people in our department for assessing health and safety issues. And you discuss with them the nature of the project and what you want to do, and you discuss the potential hazards and risks, and that's a fairly easygoing sort of back and forth, and they make sure that you've done all the right things and done all the right courses and first aid training and all those sorts of things, and you know, they don't see their job as to get in the way of what you're doing, but to make sure that you can do it safely and effectively. And so that is a bit of extra work, but it goes very well because at Imperial in our department, I would say we have very good people in charge of that.
But not just at Imperial, but with everyone that you had to deal with in Canada, was that also?
Absolutely. Yes, the Polar Continental Shelf Program, can't speak more highly of them, extremely professional and take their work very, very seriously and are extremely helpful and very generous with their time in helping you plan things and try to do everything in the most efficient manner. Very, very helpful.
And have there been any conditions associated with this field work? For instance, do we have to, if we find an amazing fossil, donate it to a Canadian museum?
So all the fossils belong to the territory of Nunavut. And currently the agreement with the territory of Nunavut is that all those fossils are housed in the Canadian Museum of Nature in Ottawa. So they have a special series within their collection, which are for fossils from Nunavut. So everything will eventually go back there and be curated there.
Fair enough. And in general, what are some of the dangers of working so far north and in such an isolated area?
Well, of course, the main danger, of course, is the weather and the conditions, that it's generally cold and you aren't going to be staying in permanent buildings or buildings with hard sides. You're going to be staying in tents. In doing so, you're much more exposed to the elements, and that means you have to be very careful about things like hypothermia. You have to be very careful about getting wet, simply the rain or falling into a stream can be a deadly situation if you can't get warmed up and dry fast enough. And of course, your clothes and things don't dry very quickly up there because it's so cold. So those are, that level of exposure is probably one of the first big dangers, and probably the main danger that I would say is out there. Animals, particularly polar bears, are the obvious concern, but they're probably something you have to worry about less than just simply making sure you take good care of yourself every day, understanding that you're working in a desert as well. So staying hydrated, staying healthy, staying well fed, those would be kind of the main things. And then polar bears, remaining bear aware, keeping a clean camp, not storing food close to where people will be sleeping. And of course, we'll have to be armed during that time. And of course, have things like bear deterrents, which would obviously be the first line of defense against any bears. And of course, doing everything to avoid bears in the first place. That is probably the best approach. But there's other wildlife that can be there that you should sort of avoid contact with. Even things like seals and potentially walruses, definitely just steer clear of them.
Have you had to do any training for this specifically?
Did fieldwork safety first aid training, which did a refresher course. You must have valid CPR training to go on these trips. The Polar Continental Shelf Program insists that everybody have a valid CPR training. Everyone in the group had to do that. We all did firearm safety training, of course, because we could have to carry firearms, or anyone could be expected to. And so it's important to know how to operate those safely, because if people don't know how to do that, they're probably more likely to hurt themselves or somebody else than a bear is. Those are the main things.
And how likely is it that we're going to encounter these perils? How likely is it that we're going to see some terrible weather versus how likely is it that we're going to see a bear?
I would say 100% for both of them, or maybe 99% with the bears. We're going to Cornwallis Island. We could see polar bears in Resolute in the town. They're seen around town. They're very common there. It's a major corridor for bears. They're denning areas on northeastern Cornwallis Island and just across the channel on Devon Island. So it's there's a very high polar bear population density on that side where we're going. So I would consider it a near certainty that we will see at least one during the time that we're there. And hopefully it's one where we all agree to keep our distance from each other.
Hopefully just one that I will shoot with my camera alone.
Yes, exactly. From very far away with your telephoto lens.
Yeah, I've got one packed, so that's all good. So who are we taking along on the trip with us, and what expertise do they each bring?
All right. So we have five people in the group in total, four of whom are either from or based in the UK. There's myself, of course, a paleoichthyologist and interested in early naphthostomes, but that goes without saying. We have Dave Marshall, yourself, who will be helping us with developing outreach for this project. And I will be studying the arthropods, in particular the Eurypterids, and hopefully get some valuable material for his PhD thesis. We have Emma Randall, who is recently finished a PhD with Rob Sansom, and she works on jawless fishes, in particular heterostracons, of which there are in abundance in the Canadian Arctic. And so it's very important to be able to identify these and know them. And in some of the things that we're studying, which is looking at the hopefully eventually being able to look at whether or not there are changes in the jawless fish fauna that relate to the jawed vertebrate fauna, we want to have someone with expertise in jawless fishes, in particular heterostracans, in the field with us. And finally, we have Anthony Shillito, who's a PhD student in the Department of Earth Sciences at Cambridge. I should say that Emma has just started a short-term postdoc with me at Solwood Park at Imperial College. But Anthony is at Cambridge in Earth Sciences, and he's a sedimentologist and an ichnologist, which means, of course, he studies traces, so trace fossils, tracks and burrows and those sorts of things. He's very interested in this time period. So he's not just helping us with the geology, but it's actually an important perspective in his work, which is looking at the origins of animal terrestrialization, which, of course, is happening in invertebrates well before it happens in vertebrates.
And then we're missing one?
Yes, sorry. And with us, of course, sorry, very tired and jet lag, is Mr. Randy Idlow from Resolute Bay, and he will be our guide. He's a knowledgeable local who's traveled around the island a number of times, guiding people on hunting expeditions, and knows the wildlife and knows the landscape very well. And so he will be accompanying us to help us work safely and you know, help us with his knowledge of the area and the land.
So that's his job, just showing people around. Do you think it'd be kind of...
He has other jobs, but what's that?
Do you think it'd be kind of a bit weird for him, seeing as he lives there? It'd be kind of like us taking someone around the south of the UK.
Right. No, I think he's pretty excited about it. So normally, so his day-to-day job in the winter is working at the airport, doing, you know, plowing the runway and things like that. And in the summer, well, he's coming out to work with us. And I think normally what he, you know, did was help guide people hunting around the islands. And we're doing something quite different. And I think he's quite excited about it.
Cool. So let's talk about some of the logistics. So you're in Canada already, but I'm still in the UK. So how am I going to get from my front door to Canada? And then how are we getting from your parents' house to the field campsite?
So you're flying over to Ottawa. We'll pick you up at the airport in 2 days. 2 days later, we will go back to that airport and fly up to Resolute. And that's kind of a long milk run from Ottawa to Iqaluit. And then you change planes in Iqaluit. And then there's kind of a local service that functions almost more like a bus than a flight, where it flies to Pond Inlet, Arctic Bay, and then to Resolute, and each place dropping people off and potentially picking people up. And so it's about a 10-hour journey up to Resolute. And there we will stay at the Polar Continental Shelf Program's facility. And we will get everything, all of our field equipment and our food, assembled into packages and boxes, and assemble what we need for day to day for several weeks. And then we'll be brought out to our field site about 3 days after arriving in Resolute. We'll be brought out by helicopter to our first sites on the eastern side of Cornwallis Island. And we'll be camped there for a couple of weeks. And then a couple of weeks later, then the helicopter comes back and moves our site a little bit further north. So they'll move our campsite for us and ferry all of our stuff over and bring some of our specimens back, hopefully, if we found some. By the end of the month, early August, the helicopter will come and retrieve us and bring us back to Resolute, where we'll have to organize returning specimens to the UK for processing, packing up all our stuff and heading back home.
How easy would it be to get back from the campsite should we have a need to return at some point, if there was an emergency or we needed evacuation because of the weather or a polar bear at all the food? Well, or...
Yeah, well, it could be quite hard if we're depending on a helicopter to retrieve us. So this summer, there's really only one helicopter serving scientific work in the Arctic. And so it could, you know, it could be, could require waiting up to a day or two for the helicopter or more if the weather is not favorable. So it could be up to several days. But we are, it is possible to traverse over land from Resolute to where we are. I mean, locals have certainly done it on quad bikes, for instance, to have gotten out that far, at least according to our guide. He told me today, actually, that one possibility is just to take quad bikes and go out there. So, in theory, it would be possible to you know, reach people over land, or even by boat in the worst case. But you know, hopefully it will never have to come to that.
So I can't imagine the mobile reception out there is going to be great. So how would we get in contact with someone if there's an emergency or we needed to get away or the weather's bad or a polar bear eats our food or anything?
So there's a daily radio schedule. So we'll have a radio and antenna with us, and then we have to check in with the polar continental shelf base in Resolute every day. And if we can't do it by radio, then we have to contact them by satellite phone.
Like in Jurassic Park 3?
Sure.
That thing that got eaten by the dinosaur?
I don't remember.
By the Spinosaurus.
Oh, that's right. That's right. It's been a while since I saw that one.
Yeah. As paleontologists, we try and forget Jurassic Park 3 as much as we can. Okay, so thinking ahead of what it's going to be like on at the campsite, what will life be like? What kind of facilities will we have?
So we'll have sort of one sort of base camp tent, kind of a geodesic dome type tent that will be kind of where we are able to cook and eat and sit around and play cards when the weather's not favorable for going out into the field. Some ways away from that, you know, a couple hundred meters away, we'll have our main sleeping area where we'll have our tents laid out in a line and, you know, keep that well away from where the food is prepared and stored. Around that, we'll, of course, have an electrified fence, which helps sleeping at night, if nothing else, as well as an alarm fence to awake us if anything sort of comes into the area in the night. Day to day, we get up in the morning, make some breakfast and some coffee, clean up and pack our gear and head out into the field.
Nice. And how far are we going to be walking in any given day? How long are we going to be out in the field for, do you think?
Well, yeah, it depends on the day, and it depends on what we're doing. Sometimes we'll be able to just kind of work maybe within a mile or two of camp. There are other times where we'll be walking much further afield. We'll be walking up to, say, 10 kilometers away from camp. Probably not quite that far. It all depends on the substrate, whether the ground is boggy, whether or not there's a lot of, sort of damp soil or whatever that's very hard to traverse, or whether or not there's rivers that get in the way, all that kind of thing. There shouldn't be too many rivers. It's mostly small streams out there. But generally, we'll be walking a few miles most days, going out prospecting or making our stratigraphic sections.
What would the weather be like? Temperature range and wind, rain, snow?
Mm-hmm. It looks like sort of temperatures range from about 0 to 10 degrees, but mostly around 4 or 5 degrees most days, getting down to maybe 1 or 2 degrees in the evening, sometimes about freezing or maybe a little bit below, but fairly stable temperatures, but mostly just above freezing. weather will probably be pretty variable. You know, it changes quite quickly up there. It can be very windy. I mean, I've not been to Cornwallis Island before myself, but in the past, places I've been, at least when I've been to the Arctic once before, I mean, you have 100 kilometer an hour winds, you have lashing rain, sometimes you have sunshine, sometimes you have snow. So it can change dramatically.
Something you mentioned then, evening, is the sun going to set?
Probably not until August. I think early August is probably the first time the sun completely sets up there. Or maybe about mid-August. So we probably won't see it set while we're up there.
And is that going to alter our working hours?
We'll try to probably keep a fairly sensible schedule. Try to keep on a regular daily schedule so that you still know what day it is, and so that people are actually getting some sleep and not overworking, because that would probably be one of the other big dangers that's easy to overlook is fatigue and overwork.
Is there any chance of us being snowed in if we hit a particularly bad snowstorm?
I suppose that's possible, yeah. That you could actually get quite a bit of snow.
Great.
No, you are going to the Arctic, right?
Yeah. So have we got loads of food prepared? What can we take?
Yes, we've got crates of food that we've sent up. You can send almost anything. A lot of people will even send up things like fresh meat or whatever. We tend to send it by air cargo up to Resolute. The airline can keep things cold for you. PCSP can keep things cold for you. So you could send foods that are perhaps more perishable. But it is a few weeks between sending that food up and going out to the field. So mostly dry goods, lots of rice and pasta, beans and things like that, tinned foods, and buy some fresh ingredients and that before we go out.
Are there any dietary requirements on the trip?
We have one vegetarian, which is actually easier to accommodate than more difficult, I would say, because when you aren't going to be bringing lots of perishable goods anyway, that a lot of your food will be vegetarian. So probably most of us will be vegetarian.
What would the basic amenities be like?
Yeah, it'd be pretty primitive. So we don't have running water or anything like that. So we'll have to store water in jugs and bags. The toilets will be basically walk off into a discreet place, and keeping a toilet away from camp, of course. Pretty basic, pretty primitive. There won't really be anywhere to shower or anything like that. So maybe occasional bird baths in the stream or something, but yes, it'll be pretty basic.
And do we have electricity? Are we taking a generator?
We've got batteries and a solar charger, but we're not bringing a generator.
Right, fair enough. Okay, and then to end on, we're going to be talking about the actual field work. So we're going looking for fossils on a fossil hunting expedition. What are the chances of us not finding any at all?
I would say the chances of us finding nothing at all are pretty slim, given that we're going somewhere where the fossils have been found before. We kind of know where they are in the sections, and they're pretty abundant. But what we might end up with is not even knowing whether or not we found fossils until we take the rocks back to the lab and process them, because a lot of what we will collect are rock samples that we'll process for microvertebrate fossils.
And as far as I'm concerned with the Eurypterids, I've been looking at what's been found there before, and there has been a specimen of the Styloneurid Eurypterids, which are the really long-legged ones that walked around on the seafloor, didn't swim or anything. And they estimated on this specimen that they found that it would have been complete about 1.5 meters long. Now, I am definitely planning on finding a few of those.
Right.
So what happens when we've got this giant rock with the most beautiful specimens that you've ever seen on it? How are we going to get it back to camp?
So we'll have to carefully reinforce some of those fossils, bandaging them with plaster bandaging. And some of them might be fairly well, fairly solid as they are. And that will have to go back by helicopter lift to Resolute.
I like the VIP treatment for my giant Eurypterids. Yeah. Sounds good.
Well, it would definitely be worth it, I would think. So,
but how many could we bring back with us? I mean, we've got small stuff as well that we're going to find. We've got rock samples. Have we got a weight limit?
Yeah, we have a weight limit of a few hundred kilograms, but a lot also depends on whether or not different parts of the trip go a little more smoothly. So if we save a bit of money on, say, aircraft time, you know, if our estimated aircraft time isn't quite what we ended up with, then maybe we get a little bit extra, which we can throw in towards either shipping costs or to to, you know, that helicopter lift that needs to take the specimen out, and our, you know, and our financial margins are not extremely tight. So
could it be possible that we leave specimens in the field to be collected on a later date by someone else, or if we go back?
Yeah, it could very well be that stuff that's seen in the ground, in the outcrops or the talus, we just simply can't collect. And that we have to take a picture of it and leave it for another day, or perhaps it will never get collected at all, which would be a shame in many cases. But sometimes not all fossils need to be collected either. So,
and how long will we be in the field for in total?
We'll be about 5 weeks in the field.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Are you looking forward to it?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Are you sad that you're going to be missing the World Cup?
Not really. Are you?
Yeah, because my country's in it, I guess.
Yeah.
It's still in it for now at the time of recording.
Mine's still figuring out this whole sport.
You got ice hockey.
That's right.
Yeah. Who will win the World Cup then? Give us a...
it's going to be Russia. They have the best referees.
Right, perfect. So I guess then, as far as this series goes, this will be the last you hear from us for, you know, like maybe 2 months or something whilst we're in the field and then getting sorted on the way back. So wish us the best of luck, and we'll let you know when we're back and what we found. So we hope to see you soon.
Yeah, goodbye, and see you soon.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/PaleoCast to get all the latest news.